How many of you can relate to that song? Can relate to the feeling that, and I'll just be honest, I have this really tall pulpit up here. It was my decision. Might have been a poor one, but I like it. It's see-through, right? So we relate to the feeling that forgiveness or forgiving another person can sometimes feel impossible. Or that forgiveness is something we say, but not always something we do. We know as Christians that it is our job, part of our job description, to be forgiving. And so I think sometimes we can be quick to say those three words, I forgive you. But actuality, in all actuality, our hearts are still harboring the pain that was inflicted upon us, that we're still holding on to it. Can any of you relate to that? Can any of you say, like, that's true in my life sometimes? Sometimes I harbor things and I should let them go. I know I can. And I'm just going to have a moment of confession. I'm calling it the confession of grudge-aholic. I don't think that's an actual syndrome. But if I let Janae's flesh rule my life, I think it could be. It could be a real one. I would put it down in Google and it would be real. So I have always struggled to forgive others, to let go completely. And so in my real world life, I love and I admire God's characteristic of forgiveness. I admire that He does that. But it's really difficult for me to manifest in my own life. And some of you might be thinking, well, you're a pastor's wife. Aren't you supposed to be like that? Yes, but before I was a pastor's wife, I was a human and a flawed one at that. And so it has always been a stronghold. And I love deeply. I really love deeply and I hurt deeply. And those are two things that can, when you put them together, I can care for people greatly. But if I didn't have or practice self-control with those two characteristics or those two qualities in my life, they could combine to be a formula and a poor, strong formula of hate. And so I'm the person who can usually take a blow. I would like to say I can take a punch. If it's to me directly, if it's an offense against me, I usually take it pretty well. However, if you attack my family, you attack somebody I love, you offend somebody I love, then it's like Wolverine status. You know, like I clench up, the claws come out, I'm ready to throw down, I can spit fire, I can throw some blows in the UFC cage, if that doesn't make sense to you, because I'm a tomboy. Just think of an old-fashioned girl fight. It always starts with words, right? And then the claws and the pulling hair comes, and then it always ends with really cheap blows. Yeah, that's Janae in her flesh. And Janae operating in her flesh can be someone who is passionate but also very impulsive. And so passion and impulse can amount to something where I am now hurting and tearing down others. Janae in the spirit is compassionate and she's constructive and she wants to build others up. And so that is me at my core. And so when I was studying this, as much as this is for you, God was wrecking me. You know, He really was wrecking me with this study and what I go through internally when I'm dealing with an offense of someone. And I believe that's probably true for a lot of you, if not all of you, that underneath each one of your beautiful faces lies beauty and the beast, right? So sometimes the beast takes on, takes on the persona of jealousy. Other times it's pride. But I think more often than not, it's unforgiveness. And I believe that because I believe unforgiveness is the beast of many faces. It's the beast of hurt, of resentment, of anger, of bitterness, of brokenness. And the worst part about unforgiveness is that it's misleading. For some reason, we have convinced ourselves that if we're unforgiving, then we are protecting ourselves, right? That we're putting on this armor and now we're not allowing any other person close enough or the offender close enough to hurt us again. We believe that we're doing something for us and not against us. But the truth is unforgiveness is not something that protects us. It's something that poisons us. And it poisons us from the inside out. It is the illusion of freedom because you're free from pain, you think, but you're really entrapped in it altogether. And it's like sinking sand and it brings you down. There is a quote that says, "Unforgiveness chains us to the past, poisons the present, and keeps us from what the Lord has for the future." If you are here today and you want to be freed from the pain of an offense, if you want to be freed from that agony, the bitterness, the resentment in your heart, forgive the offender. And you might sit here and go, "Yeah, sounds good. Easier said than done." Yes. Yeah, it is. And I know that from somebody who can honestly say, "I struggle with it." And it has to be a choice that you make and nobody can make for you. And when the beast of unforgiveness starts or begins to surface, you have one of two choices. You can react or you can respond. A reaction is a response that is influenced by another. It's influenced by an action or it's influenced by an outside source. A response is merely an answer. It's a reply. And coming from someone, again, who is able to keep a track record of other people's wrongs, I can tell you that it is really easy to react. It doesn't take much, right? It doesn't take much thought. It doesn't take much effort. It just kind of flows off the tongue in a really crude way. And it's natural. It's something that comes naturally. I can spit fire if I want to, but while spitting fire, I'm creating wedges. And then on the contrary, having a response is challenging. It even hurts at times, but it is so rewarding. And forgiveness is a test of our character. Anytime somebody wrongs you or wrongs somebody that you love, you are being put to the test. Are you going to pass or are you going to fail? Are you going to respond in love or are you going to react in anger? Are you going to be beauty or are you going to be the beast? Let's take a look at how the Bible tells us to respond. If you have your Bibles with you, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 5. And we're going to be looking at verses 38 and 39. And then we're going to jump down a little bit and look at a few others. And as you're turning there, I'm going to read it to you. And it says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also." So we are going to break these two verses down. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to look at the old, we're going to look at the new, and then we're going to look at what to pursue. So to start, who is speaking in this passage? If you have a red letter Bible, you know, Jesus, right? It's Jesus. And what is Jesus referencing in verse 38 when he says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye or a tooth and a tooth for a tooth"? Good. He's referencing quotes and he's quoting different scriptures from the Old Testament. And he is mentioning and talking about revenge. And so when he quotes these, he's quoting things that are scriptures that are kind of referencing the criminal justice system in that day, per se. Okay? And as we kind of untangle this, I want to read these scriptures, or at least a few of them to you, just so we get a little better understanding or background, a clearer picture of what we're looking at. So Exodus 21:23 through 24 says, "But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe." And then Leviticus 24:19 through 20 says, "If a man causes disfigurement of his neighbor, as he has done, so shall it be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, as he has caused disfigurement of a man, so shall it be done to him. And reading these scriptures, reading them out of context, in the context that they were written, you would happen to believe, or even possibly believe, that it's okay to retaliate. It's okay to, and it's acceptable, almost encouraged. If someone does this to you, you go out and you do it back, you know, tenfold. They deserve it. And that's not what God is saying here. And so Jesus references this because it's the complete opposite of that. However, in that day, the Pharisees were teaching these scriptures that way. They were taking the scriptures out of context and allowing this to give them the authority to do these sentences, to make sure that they were followed through, that an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And so Jesus comes here and he quotes that so that he can correct that way of thinking. And so what we need to realize is that God in no way was encouraging or permitting violence or retaliation or revenge in the Old Testament, and he's not doing it in the New. The law in the Old Testament was established to prevent people from slaughtering each other. It really was. It was the rules of engagement. A law created to limit violence, to inhibit a man from repaying someone tenfold, for seeking revenge to the tenth degree. And if you think about it, isn't that what we naturally want to do? Isn't that our natural reaction, to hurt the person more than they have hurt us? For example, there's this story, and it says, there was a little boy sitting on a park bench in obvious pain. A man walking by asked him what was wrong. The young boy said, I'm sitting on a bumblebee. The man urgently asked, then why don't you get up? And the boy replied, because I figure I'm hurting him more than he's hurting me. How many of you are that little boy on the bench? How many of you are allowing or enduring pain solely to inflict pain on the bee that has impacted you or caused you pain? Consider the time that one of your girlfriends shared one of your secrets with another person unintentionally, right? And you retaliate and share one of her deepest, darkest secrets because you were hurt so bad that you only feel that it's worthy of showing her what she did to you. So you retaliate in the heat of the moment and you share one of her deepest, darkest secrets. And I'm confident that each and every one of you have been in this scenario. One, because you're a woman. And two, because regardless whether you're the one who accidentally shared the story that wasn't yours to tell, or you're the woman who retaliated in the heat of the moment tenfold, we have all experienced those moments of heartache and pain and offenses. And although this is a mild offense in comparison to what Moses is writing about in the Old Testament, you get the message, right? You understand the concept that this law was created to bring restitution, not retribution. It was created to develop law and order. And when Jesus referenced these scriptures in Matthew, he does so, again, so that he can correct the wrongful teachings and practices in that day, and also so that he can challenge his followers. He's going to challenge them to live as he lives and to forgive as he forgives. And Jesus takes something that was morally and socially acceptable, and he turns it into something spiritual. He turns it into something where his now followers can challenge themselves to handle their disputes differently, to allow God to be the one who brings the restitution through their acts of forgiveness. And this is a good example of how God and how Jesus teaches us to put off the old man and to put on the new. And so if you read with me again, verses 38 and 39, it says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, you turn the other to him also. And so we briefly saw what was in the old, and now we're going to take a look at what is in the new. Jesus reflects on what the disciples know, and he challenges them to respond with something new, to be different. In two ways, Jesus challenges his disciples. He says, to not retaliate and to not retreat. Jesus tells us, I tell you not to resist an evil person. So in other words, don't fight back. Don't retaliate. Do not puff up your chest and hold your ground. He wants you to just kind of embrace and endure it. And so when we read this, I naturally think back to those times where someone has really hurt me, or they have really hurt somebody I love. And you know, you puff up and you're just like, you want to tell someone, hold me back, because you're just like ready to go. You're ready to brawl, right? You're ready to take them down for what they've done, the offense that they have caused. And Jesus here tells us to do the complete opposite. Jesus tells you to practice self-control and to respond differently. And in order to resist anything, we have to and we must practice self-control, right? You can't do anything, you can't resist anything without practicing self-control. And you must think and choose to think before you act. And this is reiterated in Romans 12:17, where it states, repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. For me personally, this means I have to disarm myself. That I have to choose to retract my Wolverine claws. I have to choose to take a few deep breaths and let my boiling blood come back down to 98.6 degrees and then respond, right? And Warren Wiersbe wrote, Jesus replaced a law with an attitude. Be willing to suffer loss yourself rather than cause another to suffer. The person who retaliates only makes himself and the offender feel worse. And the result is settled war and not peace. And so when I read that, I think of, you know, make love, not war. Well, Jesus goes on to tell us how to do that, how to respond in love. He says in verse 39, whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. Or to do as Paul instructs in 1 Corinthians 13, which is to be kind, to be patient, to not behave rudely, to not be provoked to wrath, to not keep a record of wrongs, to be long-suffering, to bear all things, to hope all things, to endure all things. And so do you think that that means that God is asking you to be a punching bag or a doormat? No, he absolutely isn't. But he is challenging you to extend grace to others, the same grace that he extended to you and to us. Ephesians 4:32 says, and be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ has forgiven you. The second thing I want you to notice here in these verses is that Jesus does not say, whoever slaps you in the right cheek, go ahead, turn your back and walk away. Just walk away. Right? He doesn't say that. So he says, don't retreat. You are to get slapped in the right cheek, per se, and then turn the other cheek. But what does that really mean? What does it mean to turn the other cheek? Well, Jesus is instructing us to humbly endure the offense. Why? Why is it better to endure the offense or the persecution rather than get out of the line of fire? Why is that better? Well, the Bible exposition commentary puts it this way. In order to turn the other cheek, we must stay where we are and not run away. This demands both faith and love. It also means that we will be hurt. But it is better to be hurt on the outside than to be harmed on the inside. But it further means that we should try to help the sinner. We are vulnerable because he may attack us anew, but we are also victorious because Jesus is on our side, helping us and building our character. So So by turning the other cheek, we are exemplifying what God does for us every single day. Because we offend God every single day. You might think your offense is against another person, but that breaks the heart of God. And so the offense ultimately is against Him. And then we can also follow the example Jesus gave us, right? Consider Jesus, the hours before His crucifixion, what He did. He did not run away when the Roman soldiers were coming. He knew they were coming, and yet He stayed where He was. He did not ask for mercy when they were beating Him. He did not retaliate when He was being scorned and mocked. He endured all of that. And then in spite of that, He still cried out to His Father, "Forgive them." When we turn the other cheek, that is forgiving the offender in the midst of the offense. It is choosing to suffer the hurt that was inflicted upon you and choosing not to hurt the other person in return. That is true forgiveness. And that is what we ought to pursue. We ought to pursue forgiveness. And how can we pursue that? Well, if you jump down to verse 43 of Matthew 5, you will see that it says, "You have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." So how can we pursue a life of forgiveness? Through love. Through love. 1 Peter 4:8 says, "For love will cover a multitude of sins." Love that covers a multitude of sins is a sacrificial love. And a sacrificial love is to love at all times, but even more so when it hurts. Right? When it hurts, that is the most challenging time to love another. One commentator wrote, "Psychologists tell us that violence is born of weakness, not strength. It is the strong man who can love and suffer hurt. It is the weak man who thinks only of himself and hurts others to protect himself." We are to love others despite what they do, despite what they say, despite what they think. We are to choose to love them, to choose to pray for them, to lift them up, to bless them, whether they intentionally hurt us or they unintentionally hurt us. We oftentimes, though, think that this kind of love, this is an emotion, right? That love is an emotion, and so whatever I feel towards someone, that determines whether or not I love you. And that's not the case. That's not true. Love is not what we feel, it is what we do. Amen. The scripture does not say, if you feel like it or feel love for your enemy, then love them. It says, love your enemies. Simple and plain. It is an action. And more often than not, it's a choice to be righteous instead of being right. Cadence, my adorable little girl, is in kindergarten. And this week it was so... Again, I told you this message was rocking me all week long. And she came home and the other day on Thursday and she said, "Mommy, I had a classmate and her daddy told her that if anyone ever shoves her or pushes her, that she should shove them back." And in my head, I was like, yeah, you show them who's boss. You know, like that's what my heart said. My heart was like, yeah, you don't back down. You don't push me. And then if someone is the bully and they're beating up on another kid, well, then you show them also who Jesus is, you know? And so that's what's going through my head. And those are my thoughts. Thank God I didn't open my mouth. Because before I could get those thoughts like out, my daughter said, "But Mommy, that's not true." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right. Good answer. You're testing me, you know?" And that's true. Like, if you think about it, in my mom nature, and I will just be frank, there are times that I've seen kids on the playground that they are bullying my kid or they are bullying other kids. And I'm like looking at the mom like, check it out. Your kid is being a punk. Do something about it. And it takes everything in me to like swallow and not do anything or be like, "Hi, what's your name? Oh, hi, Johnny. Could you share?" You know, like to address it really kindly. And so when someone's being a bully to your kid or someone is bullying you, you feel like, yeah, you should stick up for yourself, right? That's the right thing to do. That's what this society would say. Yes, you can defend yourself. And although it might be right to defend yourself, I had to ask myself, would it ever be righteous? Would it ever be righteous for my daughter, if she got shoved down, to stand back up and to shove the kid back? Would that show the love of Jesus? Would they know that Jesus was in her by that action? No, they might know that she can hold her own, because she can. Or they might know, like, I won't do that again. Or, you know, they might be corrected in that sense. But they will never see the love of Jesus through her if she retaliates. And so just because something is right doesn't make it righteous. And our desire shouldn't be to do what is right in the eyes of man, but what is righteous in the sight of God. 1 Peter 3:10 through 12 says, "For he who would love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and not pursue it." Oh, sorry, and pursue it. You definitely want to seek and pursue peace. not. "For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." And so you might sit here and think, okay, I can do that. But what about the people who aren't apologetic? What about the people who constantly do the same thing over and over and over again, and it hurts? What then? The hashtag sorry, not sorry people, right? Those people, what do you do then? Well, Peter asked Jesus that same question. And that's awesome that it's written down in Scripture, because I need that. I need that. I needed Peter to ask Jesus that question in Matthew 18, where it says, "Then Peter came to him and said, 'Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times?'" Like, that's a lot. That's me giving grace seven times. I've extended grace seven times, Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "I do not say to you up to seven times, but 70 times seven." What does that mean? I might need to learn some math. But it means to forgive unconditionally. As I mentioned before, in order to forgive, you have to be willing to love. And to love someone is to keep no record of wrongs. It's to realize when they have offended you over and over and over again, this time, when it was like the 20th time, that is as if it was the first time. Because you don't keep a record of wrongs. You don't know that this is a constant thing. You let it go. And as I mentioned, when we view the offense as though it was the first time, that is where and when we extend the grace of God. That is when we see and realize, oh, snap, this is what God does for me. Because we all have our strongholds, and we all have that one thing that we constantly give into. And God, time and time again, keeps no record of wrongs and forgives you without question. When we love sacrificially, when we choose to love when it hurts, that is when we can have unconditional forgiveness. Colossians 3:12-13 says, "Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do." It is through God's example, and it is through his unconditional love and his sacrificial love, I should say, his sacrificial love and his unconditional forgiveness, that we are given this strength and given this ability to extend the same. We learn from him and we just mirror him. We mirror his love and we mirror his forgiveness. So if Jesus has done this for us, we ought to do it for others. Many of you probably came in here today with unforgiveness or resentment in your heart to some degree. Many of you may have felt justified in your bitterness or in your anger. Maybe you even feel like, hey, Janae, I did what the Bible said. I turned the other cheek. You know, I didn't retaliate. I didn't retreat. Yet you sit here today and somehow you still have this pain in your heart. You may have done the right thing in that moment, but you haven't done the righteous thing in your heart. Forgiveness is a funny thing. It is not just doing what is right in the eyes of others, but it is doing what is right in the eyes of God. And ladies, God sees your heart. We can't forget that He can see under the surface. And so whether you paint a beautiful picture to the world like, oh, I'm a forgiving person, or I have forgiven that person for wronging me in that way, regardless if you paint the picture or not, and it's not happening inwardly, God knows, because He can see you beyond what the human eye sees. And He sees what is true and what is a facade. Each one of you today, I'm going to pull mine out. Hopefully you're still holding on to it. Have a rock. A rock that is by you, or hopefully in your hand, because Natalie said don't set it down, even if you have to go use the restroom. And that was a challenge, right? You're all, how do I do that? You each were given a rock today. And that rock represents unforgiveness. You might put it in your pocket, like I just did. You might conceal it in your hand. You might even put it in your purse so that you can set it down and pick it back up when you need it, right? Because for some reason we think unforgiveness is protection. And so we try to pick it back up. Out of sight, out of mind, right? That's what we think, out of sight, out of mind. But that doesn't change the fact that you're still holding it. It doesn't change the fact that that burden is still something you bear. It doesn't change the fact that it's still weighing you down. And the only way to get rid of it is to surrender it to the Lord, to give over the unforgiveness, to give over the resentment, the hurt, the pain, the anger, to completely release it and to not conceal it and save it for later. Right? Andy Stanley said this: in the shadow of my heart, forgiveness feels like a decision to reward my enemy. But in the shadow of the cross, forgiveness is merely a gift from one undeserving soul to another. Ladies, surrender the grudge and receive the gift. Receive the gift that allows you then to extend and give the gift. Right? Today, we want you ladies to lay your burdens of unforgiveness down. We want you to surrender them over to the Lord and to truly be freed from these burdens so that you can extend the same grace that you have been given to others. Each one of you was also given a little sheet, which I don't have up here. And on that sheet has three simple steps to walk you through the process of forgiveness. One, you're going to acknowledge what you've been through. Acknowledge how someone has hurt you. Acknowledge, you know, what they've done. Two, you're going to surrender that pain. You're going to surrender the effect, the impact that has made on your life, and you're going to choose to respond in love. And thirdly, you're going to walk. You're going to walk in the freedom that forgiveness brings, and that freedom only comes in Jesus Christ. So for the next 5 to 10 minutes, I want you ladies to pray introspectively. I want you, if you want to partner up with someone, please do, and walk through these steps with one another. Confess the unforgiveness in your heart. Name it, claim it, and get rid of it. Amen. You know? And so today, after you've walked through that time, after you've prayed through this moment, we over here are going to have some ladies for prayer. If you need assistance through walking through this, because forgiveness isn't easy. It is one of the most painful things, and it is probably one of the most selfless things that you can do, because it's not just for you. It's not just for that person. You are surrendering it over and giving it to God to take down the barrier that has been growing between you and the Lord, because that's what unforgiveness does. It creates a barrier between you and God. You think it's between these people. It is. It is between your relationships on earth, but it is also between your relationship with the Lord. And so you need to rid yourself of it. And so we want you to pray through this. If you want assistance praying through this, we'll have people up here. But once you've done that, we want you to take your rock and throw it in the trash. and there's a trash up there. And that is symbolic for you taking it and getting rid of it and not picking it back up. It's not going in the pretty box that's up there. That's for prayer. The trash can is for the rock, okay? So go ahead and take this time to pray.
There's a technical aspect to using centrifugal force and balance and gravity, and you're using these elements and you're also restraining them. And so there's a real ballet dance going on between the material and my hands.
My name's Luke Parker. I'm the owner at Hanselman Pottery. You can find our work in Corrales, New Mexico, in our showroom out front. And online, we have a website, and we sell through multiple retailers across the country.
I'm James Philip West. I've been here for 4 years. I am the head potter, I suppose, designer. I think throwing is a lot like surfing. There's this connection to the movement of the clay being thrown, like a surfer finds that sweet spot on the back of the wave, and he's moving with that energy. And that's what I do when I'm throwing a wall, is I'm not ahead of it, I'm not behind it, I'm right in that spot where it's moving everything. After it's thrown on the wheel, it's allowed to set. And then the handle's pulled at leather hard stage. Reform, make sure that it's round, and then allowed to cure over a couple of days.
We mix all our glazes in-house from raw materials, and the glazes are basically just water and clay and different minerals. The glaze is applied by submerging the bisque pottery into the glaze, and once it's fired, it vitrifies and essentially becomes glass.
So once the pieces are dry, they're fired once. That's called bisque, the bisque firing. After that, they're glazed and fired again. And that basically bonds the glaze with the clay body.
It's definitely more expensive than what you might find at a big box store, but it's made here in Corrales, New Mexico, and it's made by us.
The pottery we make here is made by hands, for hands. It just makes sense.
So I'm going to throw a 10-pound vase. I figured anything smaller was going to be hard to see. So it can be a violent thing. We're going to throw some water around. The first thing I'm going to do is I need to get the clay perfectly symmetrical, which involves understanding what center really is, and without it being perfectly centered, you can't throw an even wall. So the first process is one of the hardest things to learn. It takes many years to get to the point where you can control this thing. I need to make sure that all the clay is centered, not just the surface. So that takes a little work here to expose that center. Now I feel like this clay is pretty much centered. Now I'm going to open the clay to create the base, and this is where I find out if it's actually centered or not. Compressing the inside floor to because the clay now has a tendency to twist, and as if I left it alone, it would crack in the shape of an S because of this torque that I'm putting on the clay. So now we're ready to throw the first part of the wall.
Hey ladies, as he's doing this demonstration, they actually are opening it up also for Q&A. So if you have any questions regarding the company or what he's actually doing, go ahead and raise your hand and we'll come over and ask those questions to both James and Luke. Offer classes or like a group setting to do this kind of work, and just kind of like as a date night.
First question was how long are altogether? About 27 years. I studied at UNM ceramic department. I did an apprenticeship in New Hampshire for a while, and ran my own studio in the South Valley for about 16 years. We don't give a lot of classes. We're just a really busy production facility right now, and we're trying to get that settled, and then in the future possibly we can do some classes.
If anybody has any questions about classes, you can sign up for our email list, and we'll send you a notification when we have those ready.
I can't see a thing.
So. I'm a deaf woman, and I wanted to know if you teach classes for children with disabilities, if you've ever worked with such groups.
That's a great idea, but again, there's so much involved in teaching. It's another art form entirely, and I think that we would be doing a bit of a disservice to divide our attention. When we are ready, I think we could be a great teaching place, but we just need more help first. You know, we need more teachers. Right now, it's just three of us doing the whole business, and we just need more help, you know. I think in the future that could be a wonderful thing, you know.
Another question may seem ridiculous, but once you've made the vase, do you always have to put it in the kiln? Is that always a part of it?
Yeah, so we're changing clay into stone. The finished product has no physical similarity to what I'm doing now. We change it from clay to stone through immense heat. We fire the pieces to about 2,350 degrees. The glazes are empirically formulated, and they are true glass. We don't, there's no paint involved, no dyes. What we achieve in color is through atmospheric conditions and temperature and time. So the finished product can last forever.
So, James, we just had a question about whether or not we sell the work. And we do sell the work out of our gallery in Corrales and online on our website. It's hanselmanpottery.com. And the gallery is located in Corrales, New Mexico.
When you start with a block of clay, do you have in mind what you're going to make already, or do you just sort of let the clay talk to you and say, you're going to make me into whatever it is?
That happens for the first 15 years. And then after that, then you can start control it a little bit. Today, I think I wanted to make something that was you could see. And we're just going to do a simple globe-style vase here, just so you can see the process. The rate of turn of the wheel versus the rise of the wall is absolutely symbiotic. They must be together. If the wheel turns too quickly or too slowly, you will lose symmetry. The clay is so soft right now, and so there's just a lot that can go wrong, but it's a joyful experience every time, and you have to be present every time. You can't let outside influences affect the work, and so one of the reasons I got into this art form was because of that. It's even in a production setting, it's highly meditative and requires my attention each time. No matter how small or how big the piece is, if it's not done the same way, it'll show in the work. So,
James, we just had a couple of questions about throwing.
Okay.
They're wondering whether you're pulling or pushing.
I'm doing both. When I actually throw down the wall to expand it, so I'm pushing downwards now. I like the thickness of the wall for the most part, so I'm just kind of shaping the piece and being careful not to overextend anything. I'm working with centrifugal force. I'm also kind of fighting it, and so you kind of have to find that balance. And everybody has a little bit of a different technique to do that. Yes, this piece is for sale. It really is a wonderful business to be in, because it really it kind of takes people to a place that it really connects us. Ceramics is part of all of our lives in some way or another, and being able to make it the way it's been made since the ancient Egyptians who discovered this process. It's just a wonderful thing, and I encourage anybody that has interest in it to do a little research and find that it's just a vast, wonderful art form. And Okay. Yeah, so what I'm working with right now is what we call a stoneware, which means it doesn't mature until about 2200 degrees. And the reason for that is because we want it to be impervious to food, acids, water, liquid of any kind. And so the only way to get that is to use a durable glaze that's been fired to a very hot temperature. The stuff that we buy at the stores is kind of the same thing, but it's fired much lower, but it's still what they call stoneware, which means that the clay has been fired to at least 2100 degrees. Okay. Definitely. So those were hand-dug clay bodies, still are, and those tend to have a lot of what they call secondary and tertiary clays. They don't have the durability, they don't have the feldspar and the natural sources of alumina to make the clay durable enough to go to that temperature. So all of those Native American pots and a lot of Eastern European pottery is fired much lower to achieve color, and but they're not as durable, and so it becomes a more of a visual thing. But nonetheless, all clays have their optimal temperature range. Pit-fired clays and what have you, they're fragile, but they also have other qualities to them that make it easy to work, that take decoration beautifully and what have you. They're just not as durable. So when you see Chinese pottery in a museum, it's been fired to a very hot temperature and it gives it a really great lifespan. Okay, so we're just going to fill this just out a little bit. Do I have time to throw another piece, or am I doing here? I think I'll throw a bowl if I can.
What color is your vase going to be? Do you add color? Is there color there, or and then it comes out after it's been fired, or do you do that before you fire it?
So we add the glaze after the first firing. So these things get fired twice. The first firing allows the piece to be handled and is fired to about the temperature that an earthenware vase would be fired. Then we glaze it. And then it goes back into the kiln and it's fired to 2350. So all of the color that we'll achieve will be from the glaze application and the heat and time in the kiln. A little piece, you said? Okay. Yeah, let me get this body a little fuller. Yeah, you could bring that up. It would be good.
So we had another question about lessons. We don't offer those, but someone asked about apprenticeships. We do offer apprenticeships. We are hiring. If you have a background in ceramics, please come by and interview. We're having a hard time keeping up with orders. So come by any time to tour the studio or interview for an apprenticeship. That was yours, right?
So this piece will get trimmed a little bit. When it gets to what we call leather hard, I can pick it up and invert it and trim the foot in if I want to, or add scoring or decorative appendages, handles, or what have you. So right now I could never do that. It's way too soft. So So I'm going to just release it from the bat. Should I throw another piece, or am I done? I can't see anything.
Should we
wrap it up? Okay. Thank you guys very much for having us out. And this would be about 125, something like that.
Oh, James, did you mention anything about the studio tours?
Whatever's cheap. Yeah, but I definitely have to do that pretty often. And yeah.
Sure. So we should tear down this stuff. Do you want to announce the studio tour thing, or should I?
You do it, because okay. I don't know what you're talking
about.
So
can everybody hear me now? I think the last time it was a little quiet. Yeah? Good. Okay. So we have a studio in Corrales, New Mexico, like we mentioned. We'd like to invite you all out for a tour anytime you like. Please give us a call to schedule it, but our doors are always open. Thanks for having us.
Once again, we just want to thank Cancelmen for being here. They're amazing and super talented. Yeah. And make sure, if you hadn't yet, you can get up even in the middle of this time and get your email put in that, or make sure to stop by their gallery. But I'm just going to give you guys a few examples of what we can make with the clay. It almost ties into that forgiveness aspect. And obviously a lot of you are super creative, so just go with what you want to do. But I also wanted to give you guys a few examples with that as well. So the first thing I'm going to make is like a little ring holder. It turns into a little turtle, but it also can set and turn into a ring holder as well. So this clay is meant to air dry. You can keep it in your little thing if you want to continue to play with it, but it will over like 72 hours dry. So it's super fun. So if you do want to make a little turtle ring holder, you just first start out with a little ball. I like divided my clay in half, and then you'll make 6 other small pieces, 1 for the head, 4 for the legs, and 1 for the tail. But are you guys all having a good time so far? Cool. So one of the things that I love about clay, and really I've taken just a short pottery class before, and one of the cool things is one of the materials that actually is super forgiving. You can kind of play with it and mold it and start over. And the clay class that I took, he didn't have to do this because he's talented. But you can like build and then kind of break down if you didn't like the shape of your clay or whatever. And I feel like God kind of does that in our lives. He builds us up, but he also takes things away, and he molds us. And through different seasons in life and through different just challenges and things like that. So just a reminder, and as Janae spoke earlier, of just like there's going to be different seasons that may seem like the pressures of life are just caving in on you. But God's working, and like he's not done with us yet, which praise the Lord for that. But it's really exciting, and I think clay is one of those things where we can really just connect with. There is a verse in Isaiah that talks about God being the potter and us being the clay, and that we can, through life, we can be the work of his hands. But it takes a process. It takes different things in our lives that will refine us and kind of turn us into that work that God is really working on and creating us to be. So with this turtle, with that big piece of clay, the big ball, I just kind of flatten it out and create like a little divot in it so that your rings can sit in or any other jewelry. This is just a really simple piece. Doesn't take too much effort. I don't know if you guys can see that. There's just kind of like a little divot. And then with the other 4 pieces with legs, you can just kind of set those on the side and connect them to make more of a little turtle. I don't know if you guys can see the little turtle forming. And then the biggest one you can make into his little head. And then you can just use a small piece for the tail. And then once you're done with it, he's a little turtle. Aw. But yeah, once he dries, you can put little different things into it, which is super fun. And then also, just to go along with what Hanselman did, you can do with your piece of clay, you can actually make what they call a pinch pot, which is really like a little pottery pot that's made with your hands. So that's another option. One of the things that I found like online to do that is you can take another like half of it and create a ball, which will make the bottom of the pot. And this is a really just fun way and almost practical way to use the clay. And so you can make, if you want to go with this option, you can just make a flat portion. And then with this one, I just rolled out to like a really long to make the siding of the pot. And you can flatten those out. And surround your bottom. You guys go ahead, feel free to be creative with these, but it's just really fun to make. So it's just a really simple like pot holder that you can put different things in or whatever once it dries. So there's that. And then the last, but this one's actually my favorite. It's actually a little bird, which is really easy to make, but it actually turns out pretty cool. And this one, it also starts out with a little ball. So once you have the ball, you can roll it on the table, like a portion of it, to make more of like a triangle shape, which is really fun. I thought it was really cool when James was doing the demonstration about how he talked about that he had to kind of push and pull on different places to make the pottery. And I love how that just like totally relates to our lives. And even Janae was saying like not just to turn the other cheek, but actually to take the blow from it. And I feel like so often in life we have to take the pressures of life and really not just like live through them, but accept them and thrive through them. Because it really does refine us and make us beautiful. And so that even with this piece, it's just like that pressure, and it's making something that God can really use. So once you get to this little like triangle guy, you take the main bigger part and you kind of move it upwards to make the head of the bird. I don't know if you can see. And then with the back, that's going to be his little tail, which you can like put it up and kind of flatten it. And then on the very front, you kind of create like a little bit of a beak. And it like so easily becomes this little like Tweety bird. So it's really, really fun. So those are the ideas that we have. But I just kind of want to leave you guys with a little bit of encouragement. That verse that I talked about in Isaiah, it was 64:8. It says, "But now, O Lord, you are our Father, we are the clay, and you are our potter. We are all the work of your hands." So we must undergo submission in our lives, whether that be in forgiveness or any other area, in order for us to become what God is creating us to be, in order to become that work of his hands. It's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. Just like what James was saying, it takes several days, and if not weeks. Some of their pieces take 3 to 5 weeks to come up with a final product, and God's the same way with us. If you don't wake up tomorrow feeling like you've conquered the world, it's okay. God's not done with you yet. But I just want to let you guys know and encourage you with this to be women with soft hearts, not hard hearts. Let us not retreat, but let us relate. And then let us live, obviously, like the name of this event, let us live bendable, not breakable lives. So I hope you guys were all blessed by this. We're really excited.